Good morning.
You may be seated.
Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals.
Before we get started, I wanted to let...
Well, we have some new technology in the courtroom today, which you are hearing.
Is that... How do you turn this down, do you know?
I don't know. Does that work?
Well, I'll try again. Okay, it seems like it's turned down and the echo is gone. Starting today, we are live streaming our oral arguments, which is very exciting. We're glad to increase our access of our oral arguments to the public, and so you will notice some technology in the courtroom to make that possible. There are some meeting owls, which I don't see, but I assume are, you can see them from council table and those of you who are in the gallery. I just want to make sure you're all aware of that we will be live streaming our oral arguments today. We will also be recording them as we have in the past, and those audio recordings will be available typically within 24 hours on our website. And just a reminder to everyone who's here and anyone who may be watching the live stream that other recordings of our oral arguments are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. So if you are watching on the live stream, please don't record the oral argument. You can access the audio recording tomorrow on our website. So with that, I will turn to the calendar for today. We have three cases on our calendar. Today is September 13th, 2023, for purposes of the recording. The first case on our calendar today is A23-034 in the matter of the welfare of GVG. Council, you're familiar with our procedures here today, so as you know, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The time is on the podium, and the podium is adjustable. So we can proceed when you're ready, and if you can introduce yourself and the party you represent when you begin your argument, we would appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you and good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Steve Slisher and I represent the appellant GVG, who is the accused in this matter. The accused, Your Honors, has a constitutional right to face his accuser, to fully challenge the state's evidence, and to present a complete defense. GVG, in this case, was precluded from doing so. And that is why we're requesting a new trial of this court today. Your Honors, I think it's important to put the decisions and the legal matters in proper context before we start, and to just plainly state this was a credibility case. This case is based solely upon the allegations of AB. It's based solely upon the allegations of conduct that she said happened years ago. There was no contemporaneous evidence, no contemporaneous reporting. There's no physical evidence, there are no other eyewitnesses, no one other than AB. And so that's it. The decision is based on her credibility and nothing more. And while the testimony of a single accuser is in fact sufficient to sustain a conviction, in the face of that, the accused must be afforded a full and fair opportunity to defend himself against these allegations. And GVG did not receive that opportunity for the following reasons. First, the court erroneously excluded expert testimony regarding false memories and the role of therapy, including EMDR therapy, which completely gutted the defendant's ability to challenge AB's credibility based on her incremental reporting and evolving accounts of what happened. Keep this in context of what was allowed. Barbara Kern-Pye, a SANE nurse, was allowed to testify that incremental reporting is in fact normal in cases such as this. And so when you take a look at what was allowed versus what was disallowed, you can see a complete mismatch. Second,
Mr. Schlueser,
yes, Your Honor.
The proposed testimony about false memories, is that novel in Minnesota?
It is not, Your Honor. It's not novel in Minnesota. If you take a look at the decision in the Archdiocese versus Doe case, Minnesota Supreme Court, in fact, relied upon the science and phenomena of false memory to discount expert testimony regarded implanted or recovered memories during therapy.
Wasn't that the real issue in the appellate opinion about repressed and recovered memories, not false memories?
That's correct, and that's why we indicated it was implicitly accepted, Your Honor. In order to come to the decision they did in Archdiocese, the court relied upon the scientific phenomena of false memory to discount repressed and recovered memories. And in fact, one of the experts that was used to make that decision was Dr. Harrison Pope himself, the very individual who the defense noticed and had testify on our behalf.
So, I think part of your argument is that the district court or the juvenile court did not conduct a Freimach hearing. And I guess I have some questions about the procedures, about how that happened. I mean, were you or your colleagues, did you come to court that day prepared for a Freimach hearing?
Your Honor, trial counsel came to court prepared to put testimony on, including testimony from Dr. Pope himself, if requested. In the face of just to put into context how the objection occurred, Dr. Pope was noticed about 3 months prior to trial. Shortly before trial, the prosecution, in a one line in their motions in limine, moved to exclude his testimony. It wasn't until the trial was underway, literally.
So there was no pretrial conference the day before trial or the week before trial or anything?
There was a pretrial conference, Your Honor, but it wasn't until jury selection, until the trial was underway, that the decision was made.
Can I stop you there? So then why wasn't there a discussion at the pretrial conference about the need for a Freimach hearing or the lack of need?
Your Honor, when the prosecution noticed their objections to Dr. Pope, we responded. We put forth a fulsome response with numerous citations to scientific journal articles, which explained why Dr. Pope would be reliable and admissible, and in fact offered to have additional testimony, including Dr. Pope himself. The judge, it wasn't until the motion for a new trial, far after the trial, for the first time indicated that that it was our failure to ask for a Freimach hearing at some point as one of the basis for exclusion. The Freimach hearing itself wasn't an issue until during jury selection, when the prosecution suggested that a Freimach hearing may be necessary, and the court then, in making her decision, indicated that indeed she thought perhaps a Freimach hearing would be necessary to determine admissibility. But having determined that a Freimach hearing was necessary, the district court nonetheless failed to hold one. Now, in substance, we were prepared to provide evidence.
Addressing that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead. I think the marshal addressed that.
Oh, right. Offered to provide supplemental evidence that would establish admissibility, and that just simply wasn't done. And if the court...
Counsel, did appellant make an offer of proof at any point as to the testimony that Dr. Pope would have provided?
We did notice the testimony, Your Honor, and the proposed testimony was the risk of false memories of alleged criminal sexual conduct in children and young adults, the role of therapy, including specifically eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR, in the development of such false memories in cases involving alleged criminal sexual conduct, and the incremental reporting as being sort of a red flag as an indicator of false memories. We did make that offer of proof, and again, offered to have Dr. Pope himself testify as to his own experience and the foundational reliability of his opinion. The district court noted in denying our expert that Dr. Pope, she was not willing to have Dr. Pope himself testify as to foundational reliability. However, why is that? Why couldn't a preeminent Harvard scholar, who is an expert in the field, one whose opinion has been recognized by the Minnesota Supreme Court sufficient to offer foundational reliability for the science upon which he was going to rely and testify? There's no reason for that.
Our standard of review and on this matter is abuse of discretion.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's abuse of discretion, but I also point that, you know, this impacts the defendant's ability to present a complete defense. And so there's a constitutional aspect to it as well. And so it's a mixed standard of review, abuse of discretion on the evidentiary issue, but with respect to the deprivation of his ability to put forth a complete defense, it's a due process matter, which is subject to de novo.
Raise the constitutional issue before the trial court?
The complete defense, Your Honor, I don't believe we did. Now, to get back to Justice Johnson's question regarding whether this is new or novel, it wasn't. It isn't. It's been recognized false memories and the dangers of false memories have been recognized to courts throughout the country for at least the past 20 years. And I, again, alluded to the Archdiocese case in which the Supreme Court at least tacitly acknowledged it, had to have, in order to come to the decision that it did. The government points to a lack of appellate court cases on point in the state of Minnesota. You know, but of course, the question is not the issue of whether the appellate courts in Minnesota have addressed the issue. The question is the science new? Is the science novel? And it isn't, as demonstrated by the recognition of the admissibility of this sort of evidence all across the country and indeed here in Minnesota.
But Counsel, go ahead. To follow up on that, I mean, doesn't a Minnesota district court or trial court need to follow the opinions of the Minnesota appellate courts on that issue? In other words, if no Minnesota appellate court has so held, but even though other states have said so, wasn't the juvenile court obligated then to treat it as novel and therefore to FRIMAC as required?
No, Your Honor, because that would be looking at it from a legal matter, you know, a legal perspective as opposed to a scientific perspective, and that's the admissibility standard. Is the science new? Not as it new here, not as it new in Minnesota.
So a trial court could make a determination that a theory is not novel based upon the evidence in a particular case without any precedential case law?
Absolutely, Your Honor, okay. And could and should have here.
Well, in that regard, isn't this case more like State v. Fetter than Doe? I mean, you rely on Doe, but Doe doesn't directly address the issue before us. And in Fetter, the proposed expert testimony that the victim might have learned a false memory as a result of questioning was excluded, and that decision by the district court was affirmed.
That's true, Your Honor, but I would also point to the decision of State versus Hakalu, which is also cited in our brief, which takes an analogous sort of scenario in which expert testimony regarding the suggestibility of young individuals, children and young adults in interviewing and questioning, that was allowed. And so
correct, but in you would agree, as you just noted, that was in the context of questioning by an investigator of the child. Here, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the testimony related to therapy sessions, not interviews of the child by an investigator.
That's correct, Your Honor. Therapy and the role of therapy, and it's highly analogous because it, again, is a question and answer. It's a session in which AB, in this particular instance, is disclosing certain information. And we don't have, and the jury doesn't have, sort of the perspective on how those therapy sessions can create suggestibility through conditioned responses and over time and implant false memories. And it's something that the science supports. And in the context here where the allegations that were made by AB were inextricably linked to the therapy sessions and done so over a considerable period of time, the jury was entitled to hear the counterpoint from Dr. Pope that such therapy sessions and the manner in which they were conducted here can raise false memories, implant false memories. And the incremental reporting in particular, when you look at the prejudice here as to what was excluded and what was allowed, incremental reporting is excluded as a hallmark of false memories, but incremental reporting was used to actually bolster AB's account by the same nurse who testified. And so in a credibility case, and in this case particularly, AB was allowed to testify. She testified again through the witnesses who interviewed her, had therapy sessions with her, and the corner house video. And I'd like to talk with some of my remaining time about some of the confrontation problems that we have here with respect to the corner house video. If you look at the corner house video and how it was allowed to be used and how it wasn't allowed to be used, it violated the accused's right to confront his accuser and to fully challenge the government's case. The trial counsel was precluded from cross-examining AB using the corner house video at trial. However, the district court allowed, in the state's case, after AB had testified, to play the entire 43-minute corner house video in its entirety. This was improper. The corner house video was certainly testimonial, and due to the trial court's restrictions of trial counsel's ability to cross-examine AB with the corner house video itself, a full confrontation was not realized by the accused, and he was deprived of his Sixth Amendment right to confront his accuser.
It seems to me that the case law you cite, I'm looking at pages 36 through 37 of your brief on this issue, it doesn't seem like any of the case law you cite is directly on point in the sense that somebody who has had an opportunity to cross-examine a witness, albeit not with a certain exhibit, can claim a denial of the constitutional right.
And perhaps, Your Honor, this is somewhat new ground. I can tell you as a practitioner, cross-examining a witness with a video is far more effective than cross-examining them with a piece of paper. A transcript only reveals what it reveals. It can be contextualized. I see my time is up, if I may finish this portion of it.
You may.
The amount of communication and information that is conveyed in a video, including the mannerisms, demeanor, body language of the speaker, it can't be compared to a cold transcript. The defense should have been allowed to fully cross-examine the accuser using all means at its disposal that were fair and ultimately admitted at trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petras, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. This is a sad case, as so many criminal sexual conduct cases are, as this court knows far too well. And it's also a credibility case, as once again, many, if not most, criminal sexual conduct cases are, as this court also knows far too well. and often the victim and the assailant are part of the same family. And when the victim first accuses the defendant, that family is literally torn apart. And that's precisely what happened here. The record is beyond clear about that. It's horrible. But because of those consequences of making the reports that the victim made in this case, it certainly heightens the credibility of what she said happened. Now, appellant has raised 6 claims in this appeal before the court, and I'm happy to talk about any of them, but I'll begin by addressing a few things about expert testimony issue. Appellant has not cited, and I'm not aware, of any controlling legal authority that requires a trial court to hold a Freimach evidentiary hearing before determining what the trial court anticipates will be the testimony from an expert witness, and anticipating that that testimony will fail to satisfy any of the 4 separate requirements for the expert testimony rule of Rule 702 of our Rules of Evidence. And what's in the record in this case, which of course is what this court's review is limited to on appeal and must focus on, simply does not establish that Judge Thatcher's decision during the trial or in denying the request for a new trial afterwards was a clear abuse of discretion. And particularly in issues of expert testimony, that's what the standard review is. It's beyond clear. It has to be a clear abuse of that district court's discretion.
Counsel, go ahead. The appellant argues that it was the state's burden to request the Freimach hearing, and because the state failed to do so and the district court didn't hold that hearing, it was an abuse of discretion to exclude the testimony, or at least that's my understanding of part of appellant's argument.
I apologize, Judge.
Can you address that argument? Is it the state's burden to request a Freimach hearing in these circumstances?
It is not. I have never heard of that type of requirement on the state in any case law in this state or anywhere in the country. I don't believe there's a case cited in any of the briefing that establishes the state's burden to request that. And to go back to the...
This is most directly on point as to whose burden it is to request the hearing.
I think that as the proponent of the evidence, you have the responsibility, and this is maybe not a particular case, but just a general legal principle, you have the responsibility to make it admissible if you want to offer that. And this is going to be expert testimony under Rule 702. There are 4 clear requirements in that rule that must be satisfied.
So at the point that the trial court became aware of, I mean, I think in the trial court's own words, that the need for Freimach hearing, but then the trial court didn't do it, I think because of, it was the middle of jury selection, jurors and prospective jurors were waiting, is that right?
As a practitioner, what I can say is that this issue, one of expert testimony that's being challenged, Freimach just comes up if you have experienced trying criminal cases. And yes, on July 14th, 2022, appellant did file that 1-page, 3-sentence notice about Dr. Pope's testimony. Flash forward 3.5 months to October 28th. That's when the state put out its motions in limine and specifically challenged a portion of what Dr. Pope testified to. Because to be clear, Dr. Pope did testify in this case, and we can get to the substance of his testimony in a moment. But then, so that happened on October 28th, 2022, was the state's motion in limine moving to preclude or exclude a portion of Dr. Pope's testimony. Then I believe it was on November 9th that the appellant put out a response. I want to say it was 11 pages long. 2 of those pages in that response responded to the motion in limine. And they did cite a couple out-of-jurisdiction cases and several scientific articles about his testimony. But the words Freimach never appeared in any of this. And it wasn't until the trial was underway, and I'll have to be honest, I would have to double-check the record, whether it was the prosecutor, one of the prosecutors, or Judge Thatcher, who first referenced, looks like a Freimach hearing would be necessary, given that, as going to your point from before, Judge Johnson, there was no case anywhere in Minnesota that establishes the foundational reliability or the widely accepted nature of false memory as a scientific theory.
The record after the judge made that determination, or at least suggested that a Freimach hearing would be appropriate, did the subject ever come up again?
I don't believe so until the motion for a new trial. And I'll be honest, I was not the defense attorney in this case. But if I was, and that was suggested that there needed to be a FRIMAC hearing, I would say, well, then we need to have one. And I would jump up and down and saying, if this testimony is as important as it's being characterized on appeal, without really a record to support that importance, but if it really is, why didn't the defense demand that FRIMAC hearing right there on the record, or file a motion, or file an expert report from Dr. Pope that really outlined what the substance of the testimony was actually going to be? Because we talk about this notice, which is on page 60 of appellant's addendum, that single page talking about, if I got this right, the risk, the role, and the indicator of false memories. That's it. That's all it says. I've given you the entire substance of that notice right here. That's all it says. It doesn't explain what the role is, just that he would be talking about it. It doesn't explain what the risk is, just that it would be discussed. It doesn't talk about the indicators, just that that is also something else that would be discussed. It was not at all a detailed description or proffer or offer of proof of what the expert testimony was going to be.
If a trial court acknowledges the need for a FRIMAC hearing and then says, I'm not going to do it, I mean, why is that not error? And especially where the absence of a hearing is determinative of the admissibility of the evidence.
I don't think that the absence of the hearing was determinative of it.
Well, in the district, I keep saying district court, juvenile court, in the judge's mind it was, right? I mean, that was the one reason why the judge ruled the evidence inadmissible, because there was no FRIMAC hearing to determine its whether it was generally accepted.
There were multiple reasons why the district court excluded a portion of Dr. Pope's testimony.
And I'm focusing on the pretrial ruling, not the post-trial order, which I understand may be different. But at the time of the initial ruling pretrial, I thought wasn't there one reason FRIMAC hearing is necessary, but we're not going to have one.
I believe what Judge Hatcher said is that it does not satisfy the standard, referring to the FRIMAC standard, which can be both the wide acceptance in the relevant scientific community or the foundational reliability, that hadn't been proven in any of the written filings up to that point. And she said, she may have said, I'm not going to sua sponte hold one. But again, there had been no clear request to have one made by the party that was trying to offer Dr. Pope's testimony, even when the month before it had been very clear that the state was objecting to the portion of Dr. Pope's testimony that related to false memories and their interaction with EMDR therapy. Doe versus Archdiocese, the 2012 Minnesota Supreme Court decision, it mentions the word false six times. One of those is in a footnote when it's describing a holding in a Second Circuit decision, and the other times is talking about, again, very much focusing on the issue in that case, which was repressed or recovered memories, and that you can't, you know, when a memory is repressed, can't tell whether it was false or actual. There's no in-depth or implicit adoption of the science behind false memories by the Minnesota Supreme Court in that case. So I disagree respectfully with opposing counsel about Doe somehow supporting what appellant was trying to offer in this case. I encourage this panel to closely read that decision if they are intrigued by that particular argument for what Doe actually says about the scientific theory behind false memories. And jumping ahead to what Dr. Pope actually testified to in this case, his testimony was truncated in appellant's view. I respect that. But he did provide a long explanation about the science behind how people come to remember things and how the brain works when people remember things. And he ultimately testified, he provided this conclusion over Zoom to the jury, pages 823 to 824 of the transcript. So despite our beliefs, we human beings are not as accurate and precise in our memories as we would like to think that we are. He also testified that there is literature describing that rather than people remembering past events all at once, people typically remember them in a piecemeal fashion. That's, again, page 824 of the transcript. And now there were a series of objections that the trial prosecutors raised to another portion of Dr. Pope's testimony, and that's on pages 823, 824, and 825 of the trial transcript. And each time the trial prosecutor objected, it was because Dr. Pope started to discuss recovered memories. the very same concept or theory that the Minnesota Supreme Court, recovered memories, had expressly rejected as scientifically sound and suitable for a courtroom in Doe. There was very clear controlling authority that backed up and supported the trial judge's decisions to sustain the objections that the trial prosecutor was making when Dr. Pope was testifying again about recovered memories. I want to touch on the corner house video and the confrontation issue. But before segueing into that with the time that I have left, are there any remaining questions from the panel about expert testimony?
I have one question. If appellant had expressly requested a FRIMAC hearing and the district court didn't hold that hearing, would that have been an abuse of discretion in this case?
I believe that would have depended on what the ruling in support of, what the ruling would have been and what the authority and reasoning supporting that ruling would have been. And we don't have that in the record because the request was never made. But I will say that in addition to having a FRIMAC hearing, which goes to, you know, two of the four prongs of Rule 702, there's also whether or not the expert testimony would be helpful to the fact finder in this case, to the jury, and that, of course, is the decision that Judge Hatcher also fleshed out in her order denying the motion for a new trial in December of 2022, when she explicitly found that it would be confusing to the jury and not helpful to them. I'm still a bit perplexed by appellant's argument that he had a right to use the corner house video itself during the cross-examination of AB. And I want to talk really about the practicality of what was going on at that point. AB was on the witness stand and was being cross-examined. There is a 43-minute corner house video recording that she participated in. And I don't take any issue with the position of appellant that she was, it would have been possible for her to authenticate it at some point. You can authenticate a video or a picture even if you did not take it, even if you did not record it. If you can say, hey, I was in this courtroom and someone took a picture and this is exactly what Judge Klopaki, Judge Cochran, and Judge Johnson looked like, I can say, yes, that was an accurate photo. I totally respect that position. The problem was, AB had never seen the 43-minute video. She had never seen the disc that it was contained on. It was shown as something, and she would have to rely on what other people told her as to the contents of that video and to whether or not they accurately reflected what she herself had experienced. She's on the witness stand. The jury is in the courtroom. Something cannot, and this is a fundamental principle that I know this court understands, someone cannot, or a jury cannot see something that has not been admitted into evidence. If it's going to be a photo, if it's going to be a 911 call, if it's going to be a piece of testimony that cannot be shown or otherwise provided to the jury unless it's been admitted. And if it's something is wrongfully admitted, it's actually inadmissible, it's going to be stricken. So the jury does not consider it. So
appellant notes in appellant's brief that the party stipulated to the admission of the video.
Appellant's counsel did say that. There's nothing on the record saying that the trial prosecutor agreed or objected to that. Yes. And I think that, again, speaking as a practitioner and experienced in a trial courtroom, I believe that how that statement comes in is the same way that ultimately Judge Hatcher was asked to rule that it came in, which is a prior consistent statement or under the residual exception to the hearsay rule. And that is typically, as this court has announced in numerous opinions, both precedential and non-precedential, why a corner house video recording in the context of a CSC case is admissible. And I believe that's, I think from the state's perspective, that was what the understanding was. And just because something is being stipulated to, is it being stipulated to because of an exception to the hearsay rule? Is it being stipulated to because of adequate foundation? Which witness is it coming in? I mean, if we're going to be relying on this stipulation as it's put in the record, there needs to be a lot more meat on the bones and a lot more detail about what that actually means.
Your side ultimately read or had that whole video available?
When you say available, I'm not sure if I understand your question, Judge. It was presented to the jury. They watched the entire 43-minute video. I mean, appellant, I can understand the strategic reasons for not wanting to do this.
So the trial court, was there an objection to that?
Appellant did not, I see my time is up, Judge Cochran. Can I finish answering the question?
Sure, briefly.
Thank you. The 43-minute video was shown during an examination of a later witness, the interviewer of the corner house video, to the jury.
Do you have any further questions? Judge Klapacki, do you have any follow-up? Okay. You can briefly summarize and be done. Yeah. Thank you.
My point is about the corner house video is that I don't know how they would have been able to authenticate it with the victim unless there had been a request, which again, one was not made by the defense, to have the jury vacate the courtroom or have some sort of pause in the trial to show the 43-minute video to AB, to the victim, so that she could properly authenticate it, so it could be shown to her in the presence of the jury and impeached with her. That would have been an option for defense counsel. They chose not to do that. They could have recalled AB as a witness after it was admitted into evidence and directly examined her if they feel that that type of examination is so much more powerful than using a transcript. They also did not choose to do that. I know I'm way beyond my time. I thank you for this court's indulgence, and I ask this court to affirm.
Thank you. We'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's a sad case indeed. The subject matter, of course, is absolutely sad and tragic, but that does not create a sliding scale for the constitutional rights of the accused. And I would submit that when faced with a charge so serious, we have to take particular care to guard it. And in doing so, it's not a matter of convenience. It doesn't matter if the jury is sitting out there. It shouldn't rely upon not only following the rules, but somehow jumping up and down to enforce them in order to get a fair trial. Your Honor, with respect to...
So that reminds me of a question. I'm wondering, there was no motion for a continuance at that stage, at that
point?
That's
correct, Your Honor. And Your Honor, I would note on the question of whether or not the defense effectively did request at least an admissibility hearing. We offered to have Dr. Pope testify. We supplemented the record. Why in the world would the defense ask for a Fry-Mac hearing when we're taking the position this is not novel and a Fry-Mac hearing would not be required? You know, what we did was notice the expert, and when the state filed their objection, they did not file an objection based on some sort of novelty at all or general acceptance. They just argued that it wasn't foundationally reliable. And so whether you want to call it a Fry-Mac hearing, a motion in limine, it's pretty clear that the defense was requesting the opportunity to present this witness and had offered to supplement the record in order to satisfy whatever requirement that at that point the defense had to hazard to guess was being imposed here. And the court then, if it did have some indication, as you questioned, Judge Johnson, that there was a need for a Fry-Mac hearing, then she should have held one. She should have held one because, again, as sad as this case is, you have to look at it from both sides. There's significant consequences to the accused in this matter, having been convicted and forever having to register as a sex offender. The collateral consequences here are severe. And in the face of that, the courts must take great care to preserve and protect the rights of the accused at trial. And it's not a matter of convenience, and it doesn't matter if it's in the middle of jury selection. You know, and I've been a criminal practitioner for a little bit, too, and have done a fair amount of trial work. And when opposing counsel says they're going to stipulate to something, I rely on that. My colleague, my friend on the other side, does not deny that there was a stipulation. He simply says that it wasn't in the record. Well, that's a good trick, but you know it leaves the other side having some certain amount of expectations that weren't met. If they want to withdraw their stipulation mid-trial, I guess they're certainly have the right to do so, but then that does present some of the practical problems of timing, but they could have been fixed and should have, or they should have been made to adhere to their stipulation. I want to point...
Could I get one more question? I'm sorry,
yes,
about
sure.
This. As I recall, earlier you said there was a pretrial conference before the jury selection began.
It was on the morning of trial, Your Honor. The morning of trial was the pretrial conference.
before and didn't this issue come up in the middle of voir dire and jury selection? I guess I'm wondering whether there was a pretrial conference before the colloquy that we've been talking about where the judge said FRIMAC hearing is necessary. I guess
my understanding is that occurred during jury selection, as jury selection was underway. That's when the court indicated a FRIMAC hearing would be necessary.
And is that what you're calling a pretrial conference, or was there a separate pretrial conference before jury selection began?
There was a pretrial conference that occurred the morning of trial. This issue came up during jury selection, Your Honor. When you take a look at what the...
But is there a record of that pretrial conference? I mean, I'm just wondering why this didn't get flushed out, you know, at a pretrial conference, which is where when these motions normally get flushed out and before jurors get brought into the courtroom.
But I think it's pretty clear from a review of the record and the rulings and including the denial of a motion for a new trial that the district court had no interest in fleshing this out. This was evidence that was going to be excluded. And first, she said it was excluded because of foundational reliability, then suggested a FRIMAC hearing, then after the fact suggested that the evidence somehow wouldn't be helpful to the jury in evaluating sole credibility case that came out completely in the context of therapy, including this EMDR therapy, which has some controversial aspects. It's an astounding finding, and it was merely an after-the-fact justification of what she had decided before the trial started.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Further questions? All right. Thank you to both parties. The case was well-briefed and well-argued. We will issue our decision within the statutory time.